Hi, y'all. Welcome to the Filmmaker Toolkit Podcast. My name is Sarah Shackett. I'm a craft writer over at IndieWire. And for today's episode, I had the pleasure of talking to Thomas Kail. You may know him from such things as Flossie Verdon and Hamilton, but he was also recently a director and executive producer on We Were the Lucky Ones, which is the Hulu series about a large family of Polish Jews who attempt to navigate World War II and either stay together or find each other again throughout the whole breadth of the war. And you know, Holocaust stories at this point kind of have their own baggage. They have like things that we expect to see in them and cliches that can at best dilute their impact and at worst allow them to be twisted into something that justifies evil and oppression in our modern day. But We Were the Lucky Ones is a surprising show in several ways, including how it is structured, the bold ensemble focus of it, and the rhythm that Kail and his fellow directors bring to this story. So I got the chance to ask him about all of that, about the surprises that he found in the edit, about his order for Passover Seders, and a whole lot more. So I really hope that you enjoy this conversation with Thomas Kail. The show has a really wonderful look that evolves and gets sort of more dire as the circumstances in Europe change. So I would be very curious to ask you about sort of like setting the template in the pilot and then working with the other directors who came on to sort of trace how you evolved the look of the series.
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, Tim Ives shot the first three, and Tim and I had done Flossie Verdon together. And we talked a lot about in those early days, and you know, and Amit Gupta and Niyasa Hardiman were also around. And the thing about directing television is it's a relay race. And sometimes you get to go around the track once, twice, five times, whatever it is. And, you know, we talked a lot about something that I think really was evident in Erica's scripts and that we found in the book, which is if we can make this vivid and visceral, and because the family's point of view is our point of view, and we don't know anything that they don't know, there's no reflection back. There's no, we lived through this, and now we're going to go and show how it got here. That first personness also was something that we talked about in terms of what the color palette was. It's a lot of natural light. It's something that we felt should feel vibrant, no sepia tone, no nostalgia, because it had to feel as urgent to them as it did to anybody, you know, anybody else that was experiencing it, or we would it feel if we were experiencing it now.
Yeah, that makes a ton of sense. And I love you talking about the urgency of it, because there is such a rich collection of films about the Holocaust that like the viewer is naturally in a place of having more information and being able to sort of see the signs that the characters talk about missing. And so I'm curious how you, like, from a filmmaking point of view, I mean, Erica's scripts have this challenge too, but from sort of like how you are building the rhythm of scene or framing things, how do you make that history that we know dangerous and vital?
I think by continuing to focus on what's not known, which is the outcome. And so this idea that one of our family members is going to be how we experience something, you know, and obviously there's a large ensemble, and everybody's point of view and everyone's experience is so distinct. We wanted to make sure that the collective feeling that we had was one that was actually informed by that individual point of view. But whether it was Genick in Siberia or Adi on the boat, we knew in episode three that was going to be an enormous contrast visually. The bleakness of Siberia, the lushness, the richness of the color that exists on this boat heading out of Europe, that in some ways was also the dissonance that Adi felt, that he knew that there was this other thing happening, but his own experience was one that felt so unfamiliar, I think, to what his previous experience had been, but was much more connected. You know, I mean, it felt a little more like going to a jazz club in Paris for him than when he got onto that boat and realized that there was this way that he could bring his skill set to sing and to storytell. And then, of course, once he gets off the boat, everything is taken away. And so we knew that Adi's point of view was going to be how we experienced that. And that's something that we just sort of you know, kept thinking about whether we were still in Poland, you know, with the members of the family that were there, or as far flung as where he was going.
Is that map for you just notes on the script? Are you like sort of a rigorous shot listing kind of a guy? Like, kind of how do you approach that from a scene construction level?
For me, I don't storyboard. You know, even if I'm doing something that's relatively sort of larger in scope, like on like a musical number or something like that, and another thing, like even on something like that, I feel like the staging informs all of it. So I feel like once you know what the scene is about, and if the staging feels true and has a deep connection to the desires and wants of the characters, then everything else tends to reveal itself. And I feel like we wanted to make sure in this, the way that we were choosing lenses, the proximity to character and feeling emotion was something that really we would let the text dictate. And then once we would rehearse it, we would start to, you know, have those ideas coalesce. I mean, you go in knowing what you want the thing to be, and obviously we'd have a lot of those conversations. But I think, you know, Tim and I in particular, we have a pretty short shorthand at this point, having made a bunch of stuff together. And so that felt very familiar and fresh, and also it then allows inspiration to come in.
I'm curious, because TV is, it always amazes me how much of a crunch it is. How much kind of prep rehearsal time did you have for this? And it's never enough, but kind of like, what were you able to do with the time that you had?
Yeah, I would say that, you know, rehearsal time is like closet space. You could always use a lot more. And it's a very New York City reference, I realize. to anybody who has not lived in New York City also understands about closet space. We got out to Romania together as a group, I would say maybe 10 to 12 days before the first day of shooting. We would rehearse during the day. We would spend a lot of time together in the evenings. And it felt like it was an opportunity to both within the construct of a rehearsal environment, get to know each other, and then also outside of it. And obviously, you know, we're trying to build a family dynamic with a group of people that have never met. So we knew immediately with this cast on our first Zoom. The cast did not meet together in person until we were in Romania. And Erica and I didn't meet a single cast member, with the exception, I think, one. Erica and Logan were in LA until we got to Romania. So all of this was done on Zoom. Fiona Weir is our incredible casting director based in the UK. And we just, as I always try to do, I tend to take a little more time in casting. And when you're trying to build a group that's going to be far from home, that's going to be in close quarters, that's going to be telling this story, I knew we had to really make sure that everybody off camera was as dynamic and wonderful as they were on camera. so we thought about that a lot. We would have those, you know, those sort of early building block rehearsals. And then again, you know, knowing once you start shooting that everything sort of disappears, you're rehearsing on the day. But at least for the pilot, we've been able to really work through things. And then, you know, Amit was there, so his prep was, you know, overlapping that. And so when he could grab people to work on things for two or three, you know, because the schedule was quite elliptical for the cast, you know, sometimes there'd be a day where someone wasn't shooting and he could go grab someone, or Nyasa as well.
It amazes me how much is possible over Zoom, and also how much like it feels like a gamble until you meet people in real life. Do you have sort of like, okay, this means we need to do this many more chemistry reads, or just like, how do you facilitate things over Zoom? This is hard.
The same way you would in the room, the pairing of people, which we did for a few of our company members, in a way was revealed itself in this form as it would in the room. And we saw wonderful actors, whether we cast them or not, throughout the process of it. And then there's something that Eric and I share in terms of both aesthetic and I think what we're looking for. We were always in sync. Georgia was a wonderful collaborator in that same way, because she was, you know, talking about casting in those early days as well. And I feel like it was important for us to always come to consensus. With this cast, it was uniform and unilateral, and there was great enthusiasm with each choice, and then we met them and just watched them coalesce and congeal together and become this, you know, really bonded group.
It is very impressive to watch the Satyrs and how much of that group dynamic we were able to get just from the chemistry between everybody, and also the how it's assembled in the edit. And I'm curious how you handle like a big group dinner scene like that. Are you sort of Altman-esque miking everybody up and letting them improv, or are you a little bit more strategic? Like, how do you handle those scenes that may not play out linearly but have to have so much heart in them?
Yeah, I mean, Tim and I talked about this a lot. We really wanted to feel like we were inside the dinner. So the cameras were on really long lenses or zooms. And so we were really in there. I think there's some of our tighter coverage was certainly during that. And because we knew the first dinner in episode one needed to show the family together for the first time and for the last time in many respects. And again, for Eric and I talking about the story, it's about a family that has dinner and then they're trying to have dinner together and it takes them 8 years. So in a way, that's really the simplest form of what we're doing, because we knew these were two Passover Seders that, you know, would link them. We wanted to make sure that we were establishing familiarity, ritual, the family's custom. Every Passover from family to family is completely different. So that's very funny when you get a group of people that have had Passovers in their own homes. So there was a lot of conversation about what it was like when I grew up or where you grew up, you know, which is, I think, also just part of that dynamic. And then we just really let them go. You know, we had a lot of fun. We would really kind of let the meal play out in sort of longer sections, you know, 2-3-4 minute takes. Ultimately, that montage in the first episode is not very long, but there is a much longer version of it, I can tell you, that I thought was wonderful and also is not in the final edit. But it was important for us to establish those deep connections and to do it in a way that felt like it had a light touch, that we were not telling people they should love this family. We were showing them why they should.
There's also like a pretty heavy, jarring montage that begins episode one, where, you know, we're introduced to Helena and she has this sort of flash of all of her family members as she's receiving news. And so like the counterbalance of the way you're using those edits feels, I don't know, like an important balance to strike. I'm curious, kind of like, is that something that you sort of always had in mind? Or are you always like finding things in the edit? I'm curious how montages come together for you.
In different ways. Kate Sanford cut the first episode. She's a fantastic editor, has a deep list of credits to prove it. She was an editor on Fosse, so we had gotten to know each other then. You know, that first sequence that's at the top of the episode came purely in post. And it came from conversations with the studio and the network about how we want to enter the story, about what those first moments might be. And as we started cooking in the edit, I have a friend who said something that I think feels appropriate about like making television or making a movie, which is that prep is like menu planning and shooting is like shopping. And then cooking is the edit. So sometimes you come home from shopping and you say, oh, I didn't get the right tomato and they were out of this and they were out of that, but I did get this and I did get that. And so once we started getting into the edit with Kate and just talking about what that initial moment could be, we thought about that scene, which is in the final episode. And then is there a way to introduce both the propulsion that the series will have, the far-flung experience that each of the members will be having, and then also to center us in Helena's experience as someone who is going to take us through this. And yet it's obviously an incredibly ensemble show in so many ways, but it also felt like it could bring us in focus-wise and give us a lens in which to watch the rest of the episode and series.
Yeah, I think it's one of those things that sort of like, you know, whack-a-mole bops down an audience's question about what we're doing and is very, very clear. But as you say, also gives space for us to pay attention to the whole ensemble. And that's something that, you know, I was really impressed by the show, how it doesn't sort of shy away from the scope of the ensemble, and that, you know, we are really getting to spend what feels like everyone's experience and balancing that. And it seems like a really tricky structural Jenga tower. And so I'm curious if that was something that was also something that you know, you were cooking on in the edit and informed kind of what stayed and what went in your episodes.
Yeah. You know, and as we got deeper into the episodes, we had established a language in those first couple that allowed us to be that much more informed once we were cutting. But, you know, the process of making the language and the grammar for a show is something that I find reveals itself. I think these scripts were not afraid to have reach and to move away from a character for a large portion of an episode and then go back to them. You know, one of the things that we talked about early on with the show in terms of the sort of the scope of the show, the far-flungness of the show, is Game of Thrones. That was a show when you were watching it, you might see a character for three straight episodes and they completely go away except for one scene in that next episode and then come back. And yet you felt connected to them. And that was something that we talked about a lot, not Game of Thrones, but just this idea.
Of
how to make sure that we stayed invested. And I will also say, like, this writer's group, you know, that Erica was leading, this team, you know, put it on the page. There's not a lot that ended up, you know, on the floor. You know, there are scenes that we shot for sure in each of the episodes that didn't end up in the show. But this was something where most of what we shot, the vast, vast majority of it, is in. And then we started to find that rhythmically there were things that we thought would play in one place in the script. And then once we got into the edit, they just started to, you know, move and reveal where they actually needed to be.
Is there a completely all right if it feels like a million years ago, but do you remember a specific example of something sort of shifting into and then locking into place of like, this is where this is supposed to be?
Oh, absolutely. You know, there were the end of episode 7 was one that an understanding, I think, for us, the way that episode ends. Now, it was the same constituents, the same people were involved, but who actually took us out of the episode was something that was revealed in the edit. You know, we had a couple sequences that are in each episode, but I remember in a couple of the, you know, the moments where we really found that playing things sequentially was dissipating some of the tension. Mm-hmm. So by starting to intercut, we were able to, again, especially because we were deeper into the series, we knew that the audience understood the pattern of the show. They knew who everybody was. And so I think it gave us a freedom to start to move in a slightly different way. So I think it feels cohesive, but I also feel like that you start to become more enmeshed with the audience. And so that allows a different kind of opportunity for the edit pattern.
This is an English language series about a Polish family, and we have a little bit of accent work going on. But I would love to sort of ask you kind of like how you kind of arrived at the place where the show is of, you know, trying to honor the culture that these characters came from while still, you know, not speaking in Polish with subtitles.
Right. Well, you know, and because we have a character like Adi, who spoke many languages and goes to many different places where different languages are present, whether he's in France or whether he's in other places. He goes.
Yep.
and then also, you know, because we have Russians and Germans starting to, you know, invade and inhabit the places where our Polish citizens were living, you know, also asked a lot of questions about what would be the clearest way for an audience to understand when something is being understood implicitly. And again, we're in the point of view of the character. So where we use subtitles and how we use subtitles is also done with intention, because there are times when people say things that they don't understand, and we want to make sure that plays there too. And obviously, as we get deeper into the series, because each of them had various experiences around with their languages, you start to then imagine, they know what this is, or they might not. This other moment, and it felt like we wanted to establish a baseline, and so to do that, we established this baseline, which is English with a Polish accent. Felt like that's the vast majority of the show and experience of our company, and that felt like a place to start. But it becomes a little bit like a Rubik's Cube at a certain point, so I wouldn't think about it too hard.
I'm also curious, kind of in that sort of finding the characters' voices, doing rehearsal, doing prep. Did you give yourself or give the cast any homework of things to watch, things to do to get ready to go on this journey?
You know, we like to try to provide resource, and then everybody uses it in the way that they do. You know, from the writer's room and from George's own personal research, which she conducted over almost 10 years, we probably had, I mean, we had a document in the hundreds of pages, probably closer to 200, 250 pages of really deep research, both about the family and about the context around what the experience might have been for the family. And all of that was easily accessible. And then there were also those things you know, you don't expect, which is Georgia would bring in artifacts from the family. And so the wallet that Adi had a replica of in our props department was, you know, outrageously detailed and specific. And then she brought in the actual wallet, which he uses in a scene that, you know, that her grandpa, Georgia Hunter, wrote this book about her grandfather's experience. And Logan Lerman plays that character. And so she actually had the wallet that he, you know, had on his person. And Logan got to have that in a scene. And so there were those things that are, you know, a little bit mystical and quite tangible. And then, you know, in our rehearsal process, we sort of said, here's a lot of access to images, to text about something. And then also the cast, you know, went on their own respective explorations. And so some of them would do stuff together and, you know, watching interviews or, you know, from the Shoah Foundation, you know, and so many, you know, other resources that existed. And then when you come into work, you have to both have it with you and then be able to go and try to play the scene.
In stories about oppression set in the past, a thing that can happen where they become cathartic, but then sort of reassuring and congratulatory, like, ah, thank goodness we don't do that anymore, or like, that got solved, hooray, there's no more racism or anti-Semitism or other things, which, you know, it feels like a danger that these kinds of stories can fall into. And so I'm curious kind of how you, to the extent that like you have this in your mind at all, think about keeping the audience on the hook, keeping them not having that like distance, if you know what I mean.
Absolutely. Look, I mean, Eric and I talked about this a lot, and Georgia started writing this book in 2008, 2009, started her research. The book came out in 2017. We wish this book was not relevant in its discussion and exploration of anti-Semitism, but it is. And maybe there will be a time when that is not the case, but clearly, you know, this is something that existed in a way when the book came out, existed, you know, long before that. And the way that the book and now the series reflect back what people might be seeing or experiencing or understanding or are being illuminated about is something that I think is certainly why you try to make something. But we were not interested in any way in having this feel like it was about a time that existed in the same way that we were speaking about how we wanted to try to capture it. We wanted it, the way that it was photographed, to feel urgent and present day, even though we knew it was always going to be set in 1938 to 1947. There's a way to make something feel contemporary without having it be set now. And I think a lot of that comes from the emotional truth and the integrity of the given circumstances. And I think that that's something that Georgia's book provided as a blueprint for us. And then Erica and the writers put on the page. And so for us, you know, there's a sense, because this is a story about a group of people who were having the experience that they had, which was incredibly different and distinct from their neighbors or other members of their own family. And their experience of trying to move through this time was one, you know, that felt like it was a companion, could live alongside some of the other stories that exist about this time period. But we also knew that there was a reason why Georgia's book resonated. There's a reason why Georgia's book is a book that was passed around and was in its 16th or 17th edition. Something about the way that she told the story, the immediacy of it, the way that the family was at the forefront, that allowed it to be accessed, I think, by people who might have had this experience, their families might have, and people who didn't know, with the same kind of immediacy.
Is there anything about sort of directing 1 and 8, or anything else about the series that I have not asked you about that you are particularly proud of or would like to talk about?
I will say that Georgia's book and the inspiration for making the series was to try to bring this family's story to a different medium so that it could live as a companion alongside of this exceptional book. And the thing about the last episode is it felt like the viewer at that point has been hopefully with us, unless someone's just tuning in for 8. I guess, you know what, you can do anything. You could watch 3 of them, none of them, you could start with 8. But if you have indeed watched all the episodes up until that point, we wanted to make sure that the moments of reconnection and connection and reunion were earned. And I think that all the previous episodes had done that, all those building blocks. And also to let them each be distinct from the other. I mean, as different as this family was, each person, you know, each of these actors brought something that was so specific that the way that they related to each other, the way that Genick and his mother reunite is completely different than how Genik and his father reunite. When Mila and Selim see each other, you know, Felicia and her father, you know, all of those moments, I think they felt earned because we'd had this lived collective experience over these previous 7, 8, 9 months. And to be back together again all felt so satisfying. I mean, everyone was just so happy to be back finally together. And I think that there was, you know, there's something about, although we weren't purely chronological because we were cross-boarding and all those other things you have to do, you know, we did shoot a lot of those reunions really towards the end of our time together. And it was a 122-day shoot. So at that point, you spent a lot of time together, even if you were, you know, on and off and coming back. And I feel like we wanted to make sure that the return to life after war felt like we were able to mark the things that were the same and all the things that were fundamentally different. And often you're doing that in what the world around, James Merrifield and his team in the mise-en-scène, or Lisa Duncan and her team as I like to say, like, Lisa didn't do costumes, she did clothes. And there's a really big difference in that. And I feel like that's another thing that makes it feel so connected to an emotional truth that I think relates to now. And so how do we honor all of those things, not overstay our welcome, and also, you know, take what's been earned? So it's always that balance just of knowing how long you want to stay at the dance before you go home.
So you leave while you're still wanted, but stay as long as you need to. That train scene, man, is fascinating in that, like, I feel there are people who would talk themselves out of letting it run as long as it does, but having sort of the, like, confidence to give it space and give it time and give everyone a moment and sort of find geographically how to separate it is just very cool.
Well, that was also, you know, when you're that deep into production, that's, you have hundreds of background, you have this enormous set, you have all elements that need to be functioning. You know, Wallace, our first AD, like, really in his full glory that day. So it also felt like this kind of apotheosis, like this arrival, as it were, for all of us to be able to be ready to try to take on something of that size and honor it and do that. And my hope is that we were able to accomplish that.